What if there were a fountain of youth pill that could add decades to your life? Would you take it? Unlocking the Fountain is a podcast about the mysteries of aging and the scientific quest to slow, stop, or even reverse it.
When do you think we're going to have the first 150-year-old? I think that person's already alive.
Unlocking the Fountain. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I landed in Kabul in 2008 on a blistering hot day at the height of summer. Kabul had been transformed in the previous 4 or 5 years. The American-led war had been underway for 7 years, and their footprint was everywhere. The airport had been rebuilt, part of it devoted to throngs of civilians, foreign and domestic, while the rest was reserved for military use. I exited the airport where the sun hit me full in the face, unmediated by clouds or shade of any kind. It was dry and windy, but the sky was crisp blue and people were happy to talk. I'm Naheed Mustafa and this is Storylines. It's been 10 years since Canada officially ended its mission in Afghanistan. Today, the country is back under the control of the Taliban, diplomatically isolated from the West. We're revisiting two documentaries I made in 2008 from Kabul. I went to hear the stories of those living there, how they felt about the change in their lives. The Taliban had been gone for almost 7 years. The new government had made big promises to Afghans and the world. Less than a decade before I arrived in Afghanistan, before 9/11, when the Taliban was in full control of the country, Kabul felt lifeless, I was told. Whoever could leave had left, and those left behind struggled to find work and often enough to eat. If there was joy, it was at home, behind closed doors, quiet so the neighbors wouldn't hear. Taliban enforcers were far more concerned with their version of law and order than with Afghans' quality of life. We'd all seen the pictures of women being whipped on the legs at the flash of an ankle, or men being smacked around for getting a fancy haircut or not keeping a beard. But in 2008, a lot of Afghans in Kabul felt free to do as they pleased. The city's population had officially swelled to 3 million, but unofficially closer to 5. Women still wore the all-encompassing blue burqas, but they also wore jeans and tunics and pretty headscarves with a full face of makeup. Men wore long beards and traditional clothes, but they were also clean-shaven, in jeans and graphic tees. This was the new Afghanistan, liberated by the West said. Politicians and diplomats called it modern, progressive, part of the global family. So I went out day after day looking closely at the signs of this new modern progressive Afghanistan, one that was buoyed by billions of dollars in aid money, but riven by corruption. A new shiny democracy built on the foundation of a patronage system that still determined who moved up and who stayed in place. I began by talking to people where they live.
Fareed and his family must be very thin walking this way every day.
Yeah.
I've seen Kabul's mountains hundreds of times on TV. They stand passively in the backdrop of news reports and documentaries. But here in Kabul, up close, I see they are teeming with life. Here comes a young boy and his donkey. The donkey's loaded up with empty jerry cans. The only source of water is a public hand pump at the mountain's base. I'm annoyed to see the little boy has no trouble navigating the steep and rocky trail in his slippers.
God!
There are thousands of people living up here, mostly squatters, who build on whatever bits of land they can find. There are houses here that are built on flat outcrops or cleaved right out of the rock. It's hot, and the wind whips up the fine dust.
How much further, Muthar?
What?
How much further?
I'm on my way with Muthar, my translator,
to visit his friend Farid, who lives up here with his family. We finally reach Farid's house. There's no street up here, no electricity, just houses and more houses. Farid's is a family of 16, himself, his three wives, 11 children, and his dad. Five of the younger children greet us. They stand in a single outdoor room that's perched over a 10-foot drop. There are no doors, no windows, just empty spaces. I feel like any minute one of these kids is going to tumble out onto the rocks below. But they're oblivious to the danger and carry on a lively conversation with Mukhtar. We make our way to the main house. There are just two rooms. One is public, where male guests sit, and one is private for family use. Mukhtar and I sit in the public room, along with most of Farid's kids and his father. His oldest daughter introduces her siblings.
Nami Lida, Nami Urahman, Nami Abdul Khalik, Nami Biala Karam Abdullah.
And another daughter wants to sing me a song she learned from an Iranian movie.
Siya narma narma, siya toba toba, siya ishq-e janat, siya mehrabanat.
There are portraits of Farid all over this room. He's a youngish man, maybe about 40, and is dressed in a traditional shalwar kameez. He wears his reddish-brown hair a bit long, down to the collar. His beard is trimmed close to his face. He's passed his striking green eyes on to each of his kids. Farid tells me he's a trader. Sometimes he sells mobile phones, sometimes children's clothes from Pakistan. As he goes on, Mukhtar translates.
If you see from outside, the wall of my house is broken and there is no door on it. This is showing this. We have no enough money to make a door to my house. My son is in fourth grade of in school, and I try to make opportunity to them to go to school.
Other than Farid's oldest boy, none of the children goes to school. There just isn't enough money. Farid's hand-to-mouth existence makes him yearn for days past.
For example, they're saying these things, the people have everything now, there's the buildings, roads. If you want, I will show you 100 families. Everyone is unhappy from government. And I'm happy from Taliban times more than Karzai time. Because on Taliban time, you were seeing there was no robbing, there was no kidnapping.
I wonder if by calling it a happier time, Farid would like to see the Taliban come back.
He says, why Afghanistan more places, no security and no safe? Why? What is the reason of that? There is no job for the people, so all people is jobless. In a 5 year spacing, the time of Karzai government, they are not assistance to the peoples like a one candy or chocolate. In a 5 years, money, like a millions of dollars came in Afghanistan, but they not help a chocolate for the people.
Just then, two of Farid's wives enter the room. They're cloaked head to toe in blue burqas. I'm relieved to see them. I wasn't sure that they'd even be allowed to speak to me. They sit with their backs to Mukhtar, but flip up their burqas to reveal their smiling faces to me. The older wife, Farishta, is in her mid-30s, quiet and serious. The younger wife, Farida, is tiny and delicate with a mischievous grin. She just turned 21. Wife number three is away. She's gone to Mazar-e-Sharif to visit her family. Farid's already told me he's on the lookout for number four.
Yeah.
More than Farid, I'm keen to talk to his wives. I'm curious about so many things, about how they see the world, about daily life and their struggles, what they think about the war in their country. But mostly, I want to know what they want for themselves and their children.
She says, from today to 10 years, I want a good future to my sons. And I want from Azad, after 10 years, he should become a doctor. and they want the son of the older wife, he should become Abdulrahman engineer.
But it's like they're talking about someone else's kids. Their children will only be in their mid-teens in 10 years. Plus, none of them is in school, and there are no plans for schooling in the near future. So doctor and engineer seem unlikely. Maybe that disconnect comes from sheer desperation.
The youngest says this life is not good, and the second one says, I want my sons take decision about their lives to not be like this.
As Farid sits half reclining against a cushion, his young brood scattered all over the room, I ask him what he thinks is in store for the future.
He says 100% Taliban will come back, I'm sure. And he says this government is not taking the security of Minister of Interior, Defense, and the Palace President. He says everything is up to God. It is God which taking decision and to make which body life good, which body trouble. Maybe in the future my sons have a good life than me.
Farid struggles alone to make a little money for his family, but he hasn't hit rock bottom. He hasn't put his kids to work. But scores of families around Kabul aren't so lucky. I walk into a room. Its walls are made of mud. It's dark, and it takes my eyes a minute to adjust. There are two big looms set up here. They take up the space from the floor to the ceiling. Right in front of the looms is a small bench. And on that bench, there are four girls. They're aged maybe 6 to 12. And their tiny little fingers fly across the looms as they tie knots in small bits of yarn. Dark red, dark blue, dark green. They're very focused. Most kids this age would be very fidgety. But these four work away quietly. Industrious almost. Every few lines, they tamp down the knots to make sure the weave is tight. It will take them about 3 months to turn out four small carpets. The carpet room is part of Zainab's home, and these girls are Zainab's daughters. She's the matriarch of this Hazara family, and like many other families across the country, they weave carpets at home on order from local shops. Zainab sets up a single gas cylinder and lights it. She places a steel pot on top and adds some onions to a little bit of oil. As she prepares lunch for her family, she tells me of their daily struggle.
She
says, in the morning I'm going to, by force I'm saying to my children to go and make carpets, to make some money for your school needs. And she says government staff saying the people life, they become a little bit rich, their life change, but it is wrong. They are saying lie, you know. You see, I'm a Afghan and so poor. If they do not make carpets, they cannot find money for eating the foods, for buying their needs to school.
In this family, the girls work so the boys can go to school. Zainab's entire home is made of mud and consists of two more rooms used for cooking, eating, sleeping, and storage. There's also a small courtyard with a vegetable patch and a tiny herb garden. Next to it is a small storage tank for water. The entire home is surrounded by a thick mud boundary wall. I follow Zainab outside where she crouches in front of the water tank to wash the potatoes she's just cut. She says there just isn't enough to go around, that she's not looking for a handout, but that with no outside help, there's no real hope for her boys.
She's in all governments exchange. I'm happy from no one, because also in communism, Talibs, Mujahideen, Karzai, all this stuff's exchange, but there was no job for the peoples. He says it's 20 years I'm staying in Kabul, international community supporting, giving money for Afghanistan. but I see nothing.
For Farid and Zainab, life is really just about getting by. With no education, there's no chance their lot's going to improve. But I'm about to learn that even when there is opportunity, not much changes.
We need to take a quick break. Storylines will be right back.
Hi, I'm Caitlin Prest, and I am here in your ear to tell you about a very incredible new show called Asking for It. Asking for It is a darkly comedic series that follows a queer femme singer whose history of violence finds her no matter how many times she runs away. It has an original soundtrack, and it'll make you laugh, cry, and feel a little bit less alone. Asking for It. Subscribe now.
A key rallying cry in the lead-up to the invasion of Afghanistan was about freeing Afghan women. In those early years, liberating women was the soft power side of selling a hard war. And in the ensuing years, some things did improve, but too many things stayed the same. Poverty remained entrenched, maternal mortality did too, so did illiteracy. Despite all that, in 2008, women were still hopeful that a different future was possible.
Mari is a young woman who decided she wanted more. She was tired of the daily struggle to find just enough to get by. So Mari embarked on a journey of self-improvement through an NGO called Partners in Revitalization and Building, PRB. Mari is heavy set and has a round, full face. She wears a long tunic and loose pants. She also wears a scarf over her head. She's got dimples and her teeth are slightly crooked, but that doesn't keep her from smiling all the time. She has a voice that's soft and soothing. Mari sits on the floor with 15 other women and with a chalk slowly marks off a piece of cloth that's destined to become a child's shirt. Mari has spent the last 1 year building up her business with the help of PRB. It's an Afghan NGO that, among other things, runs a microcredit program for women. Noor Hussein is the acting director, and he translates for Mari.
The women in Afghanistan, they are tortured. They do not have a good life. But she herself, she wants to help her family, to study more, and to be part of the society.
Mari's doing everything right, learning to read, acquiring a skill, pursuing a goal, but her efforts are stymied.
She says she started from zero. After she finished the PRB course, then she realized that she could manage it. She could run a course by herself, and then she rented this place. And she does not have much problem. The only problem she has is the rent of the that she's paying for this place, and also some machines that she needs the machines for the course. She says she cannot charge more because their economy level is not good, so she charges only 100 afs per pupil per month.
100 afs per person. That's about $2. Microcredit programs are often talked about as the best way to help raise Afghan women out of their social and economic rut. But Noor Hussein isn't so sure that it will have any significant impact in Afghanistan.
It will help the women. It will help the families. But it will not be on that level that changed everything. Through our experience, the expenses are so much, the prices are so high, the living prices, everything day by day, the basic material, the basic goods are becoming costlier and costlier. So whatever the women they earn, it will not be enough to make a good livelihood. It just participates to their livelihood, but it will not be sufficient to do all, I mean, to be enough for all their expenses. So the impact is just on that level. There should be some other sources for their livelihood also.
Traditionally, a source of livelihood for Mari would be marriage. She's single, so I ask her about her prospects.
What did she say?
It's a block of fortune that she cannot find a husband. She is now in that state, she says.
But there's a second set of Afghans, a minority, who seem to fare better than Farid or Zainab or Mari, at least in the day-to-day. Their livelihoods are directly connected to the international presence in Afghanistan. They work as drivers, translators, they run shops for foreigners, or work in hotels and guest houses.
But it's important for the new, for the young.
Mujda Najam is 22 years old. She's just finished her finance degree from university. She works as a receptionist here at a local guest house that caters exclusively to internationals. There are guests here from Japan and Britain, Canada, India, Australia, and Sweden. The 15-foot-high boundary wall and armed guards give guests all the privacy and security they need. Mujda and I are sitting in the hotel's garden. The rose bushes attract all kinds of butterflies and interesting bugs, while the tall trees provide much welcome shade. Mujda's worked at the guest house for 5 years, but she wasn't always as comfortable here as she is now.
After Taliban time, I came to the guest house and I work here. At that time, nobody was work outside, no woman. When I came here, I just cried. I cried. I told to my mom that, Mom, I'm not going there. People are telling me something bad. Because nobody's working outside, no woman, no girls, only me, and it's not good for me. When I came here and I gave an interview, I met a woman, doctor. She was staying in our hotel. She was a guest. And she just sat and taught me what to do and how to come out and how to work here. You should be work here and you should be proud of yourself. So after that, I just said, I feel a little bit okay, good. Then I talked to my mom, no mom, after this I'm going to work.
Now she's like a lot of the young women I see on the streets of Kabul, dressed in trousers or long skirts with a long shirt and a headscarf, moving about freely, employed or going to school. Mujda doesn't worry about her next meal or the next 10. But like so many other Afghans I've spoken to, Mujda also thinks back to the Taliban era with nostalgia.
I think that was okay. I think that is okay for the woman, for a Muslim woman, that was good. Not open face, not going outside, but nobody can die at that time. Because they're staying in their home, the men were work, and they can find good money. But nobody's dying outside. Now every place is getting explosion, bomb blasting. And in one day we are losing about hundreds of people. But that's not good for us. I have smaller brothers and sisters, but they're going to school. Every day when they're going to school, until they're coming back, my mother's sitting crying for them. At least they're coming or not, they don't know. That when they're coming and when they're going back, it's not for sure that are they coming alive or not.
Mujda is engaged to be married, but she says the big day is still several years off. Her family still needs her income. I ask her what excites her about her future and what she hopes to accomplish, but she's more pragmatic, concerned about fixing what's wrong in the present.
They just built some buildings, but nothing has changed. The government was working very well, but now they're not working outside. They're just thinking about themselves, about their pocket, about their money, about to build, how to build some other buildings. But the buildings are not important for us. The most important thing is to just make a good life for the people. If we have some factories that the people who don't have jobs, they go there and work there, they come back, and they have some money for their children to bring some food. That will be better for us, but not the buildings.
Looking at Mujda with her manicured nails and her pretty makeup, I should be surprised to hear her and Farid, Zainab, and the others I've met think back to Taliban days as good days. But I'm not. And I'm astonished that I'm not. It makes me wonder what the last 7 years have accomplished in this country, when people start to feel that the worst of times was actually the best.
In 2021, the Taliban came sweeping back to power. Sitting in Canada, watching it all unfold over social media, punctuated by tense conversations with friends in Kabul, I saw province after province fall. Women who'd made and maintained international connections were fleeing. A friend who worked in government refused to leave his home, his anxiety dialed way up. He sensed a return to the days of his youth under the Taliban's watchful eye. Sometimes there would be a tidbit of information about a negotiated deal between a Taliban commander and local representatives in rural parts of the country. Sometimes there would just be a tweet blaring that the Taliban was now in charge. The Taliban's efforts to retake the country cranked up as the last of the American and international forces began withdrawing from the country. The Afghan military had never been adequately trained. It was a chronic problem, talked about incessantly for two decades. On the 15th of August, 2021, the Taliban arrived on the outskirts of Kabul. The country's president fled. The Taliban was back in charge.
U.S. evacuation flights from Kabul have now ended. The last U.S. troops have left the country.
The U.S. plane was wheels up, signaling a final end to a 20-year mission and leaving a near-deserted airport to the Taliban, which has yet to announce its own government. Sounds of Taliban celebratory gunfire echoed in the night over Kabul.
It's been nearly 3 years. After some initial confusion, the new government indefinitely postponed formal education for girls over the age of 12. Women's public life is mostly finished, with no right to go to the parks or to gyms, their ability to work in any sector except health and education virtually non-existent. The country is internationally isolated with limited opportunities for aid. $20 years and trillions of dollars, all to end up right back where it started. That's all for Storylines for this week. Today's episode was reported by me, edited by Donna Cressman. A version of this documentary originally aired on CBC's Dispatches. Storylines is produced by Julia Poggle and Craig Dessen. I'm Naheed Mustafa. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.